leading the operation. He's charged with conspiracy, distribute heroin and cocaine. An email seeking comment was sent to Chavez Reynoso's attorney early this morning. Six others are facing a variety of charges related to the operation that sourced drugs from Chicago and then sold them out of a rental unit in Milwaukee. Police are still searching for one of the men charged in that case. And a nearly 100-year-old theater in Antioch, Illinois, is reopening following a $750,000 renovation. The Daily Herald reports that the Antioch Theater's official opening will be today. Tim Downey bought the downtown structure last summer. He invested $300,000 in the project, which included extensive renovations, replacing utilities, and installing a sprinkler system. The Village of Antioch also provided a low-interest loan, and the project received individual and corporate donations. Downey says he's been overwhelmed by how much the theater means to the community. Mayor Lawrence Hansen said, quote, "A big part of the history of Antioch is in that theater. The structure was built as a live performance house back in 1919, and at that time was known as the Majestic Theater. In 1924, it was converted and renamed the Antioch Theater." Coming up now on 11 and a half minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. The NBA, the Bucks will play the Lakers in Los Angeles tonight, and the Bulls host Minnesota. The National Hockey League, the Blackhawks play in Tampa Bay. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Friday the 27th. Sunny and bitterly cold, a high of 16 above, wind chills to 23 below zero this morning. Perspective on that number, normal high this time of year, 36. The record high was 65 degrees, February 27th, 1976. Tonight, clear and very cold, a low of 6 below. Saturday, sunny and 19. Sunday, looks like an inch or two of snow with a high of 29. Right now, sunny, blue sky, very cold, 3 below zero. In Racine, 5 below for Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind from the northwest at 8, wind chill 20 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 12 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, in just a moment, we're going to be bringing you an interesting conversation with Blair Tindall, who is the author of a very intriguing, much discussed memoir some years ago called Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music. This is a memoir which was published 10 years ago, and at that time I had the great pleasure of speaking with Blair Tindall about her fascinating book. That memoir has now been converted into a highly regarded television series of the same name, produced for Amazon Studios. And that series stars Malcolm McDowell and Bernadette Peters, among others. And the program has just been renewed for a second season. It is a show which is based on this book, which in which Blair Tindall takes us behind the scenes of professional music making as she herself, of course, experienced it. Fascinating book, fascinating story. And we're going to hear a portion of that conversation from 10 years ago with Blair Tindall. My first question to her was, as the time that she was living in New York City as a professional oboist playing for groups like the New York Philharmonic and for the occasional Broadway show, did she have any inkling whatsoever that what she was experiencing would ultimately be the fodder for a best-selling book? Did she think it would be something she would be writing about at some point?
I had absolutely no idea that I would ever write about these things, although I have to say that my mother set the writing career in motion, I think, when I was a very small child and we were living in Europe, and she had me keep a journal back then, and I was only 7 or 8, and write everything down. And she kept saying, all of this is going to make such an interesting story someday. But when I was immersed in it and really living the struggle of a classical musician who's a freelance worker, it didn't seem that fascinating. It just seemed like something, like a very, very difficult lifestyle. But when I had the time and space to step back from it and also the tools to write about it and analyze it, I realized what an interesting story it was, but not just interesting, what an essential story it is to anyone who loves music, as I do, or anyone who has a child who's very talented and might want to go into a career in classical music.
You experienced a lot of wonderful music when you lived in Europe, of course, Vienna primarily, and then you eventually moved back to North Carolina. And we get this sense that you were a bit out of step musically with most of your classmates. You say at one point, my classmates bopped along or hopped along to Beatles songs I didn't know, so I secretly hummed the magic flute tunes that reminded me of Arlene Auger's Magic Transformation. I mean, it isn't every 8-year-old who has the magic flute running through their mind.
Well, there was a wonderful element to growing up with classical music, and my parents are academics, and they're older. They were much older than the parents of my contemporaries. So that was the music. I mean, they were pre-rock and roll, and that was the music we listened to at home. So I really wasn't exposed to rock and roll, and there was unfortunately also the element of being a nerd at school, which I'm afraid a lot of classical music lovers end up being labeled such. But there really was a divide, and I had a hard time relating to the music choices of my contemporaries, say, when I was in my early teens, because by that time I'd played the piano for many years, and I was playing the oboe, and this was my music. This was something that really did turn me on. I mean, I did very much love this music. And there comes a point, I think, with young people where they just don't understand classical music. It's regarded as something nerdy, so they won't even listen, or it's something that they feel like they can't understand. So there becomes this great divide between popular music and classical music, which is a shame because it's really the same music, and all music is based on the same principles. It's not that different.
Music, of course, it begins to exert a very powerful hold over you. And not only that, but as you branch off from the piano to the oboe, you say you began to get a sense that you were good at music and nothing else. I mean, was that literally true, or is that a mistaken impression which you had at that point?
That's not literally true. As it turns out, thankfully, I'm good at many things. But I think there's an element to the psychology of somebody who's involved in the arts, which is actually starting to be formally addressed. I've been talking for the New York Times, some of the articles that I've done, to Harvard psychiatrists, all of whom say, you know, there's really this emerging field, since the arts have become so big in America in the last 50 years, of what happens to people who go into the arts and how they're regarded by people around them and how that affects their state of mind. So a young person, say you have an 8-year-old child who's very good at playing the violin. They're going to be singled out. They're going to be put on stage, I mean, rightfully so, and their talent celebrated. But perhaps somebody who's very good at math or someone who writes terrific stories at the same age might not get the same degree of reward and celebration and recognition. So it kind of, I think that music is sometimes regarded as one of those party tricks by somebody who doesn't play an instrument. Like, how in the world do you do that? How can you communicate in that way? And it is a wonderful thing, but you come to believe that this, you're very special for this one thing. And there are times at which I kind of felt like an idiot savant. You know, I'd express an interest in something else, and someone would say, well, you know, why are you interested in going into that when you're such a wonderful musician? But indeed, I have to say, most musicians I know are quite intelligent and quite talented over a broad range of subjects. So I think it's a shame if anyone gets discouraged from broadening their interests like that. And indeed, it can become a problem later in life, because if you do narrow down your education and your field of interest, not only have you kind of walled yourself off from other employment possibilities, which really can be a problem. There's not that much paying work available to classical musicians. But it also limits the way that you're able to communicate with your audience. I mean, a broad education, I think, only makes musicians better spokespeople for classical music.
Well put. You also talk about how for your entry into this world of as a professional musician, that, you know, in some respects, it wasn't this burning desire. I mean, as much as you loved music and as much as music was important to you, you didn't exactly have this as an enormous dream. You say at 14, I had no idea how people eventually became doctors, lawyers, or professors. I didn't particularly want to become a professional musician, but at least I could survive that way for the next few years, enjoy even more attention, and see what happened. This vague, unguided process was how many of my young friends ended up in musical careers before they were old enough to decide their life's work. I hadn't stopped to think about that, but I think you're absolutely right that many musicians enter this world with that little bit of air of hesitancy. I mean, in not exactly the way that we might imagine.
Well, it's often described, thank you for recognizing that, it's often described as a young person's dream, you know, to be a classical musician. But when you think about it, a 10-year-old child, a 12-year-old child, how can they really honestly be making an informed decision about something like that? I mean, they want to be astronauts and ballerinas, too, but not all of them end up doing something like that. But with music, you have to start so early to develop your skills that you have to make something of a career decision very, very early. And I think at the time that I was coming up through the educational system, people didn't really think about how classical musicians were going to make a living. There was this feeling that, oh, we now have this great cultural life in America since the 1960s. There will be just performing arts centers and jobs for everyone and culture everywhere. But there is all of that, but it's still extremely difficult for most people to make a living doing this.
When you went off to the North Carolina School of the Arts, you really had still more powerful musical experiences and some also, you know, kind of unhappy experiences with unwanted advances and that kind of thing. But, I mean, you really experienced also thrilling music making. That you talk about the first orchestral rehearsal that you were a part of, and you said the melodies being played all around me reverberated through the hall, but also created a physical sensation that I'd never felt while sitting in the audience. It was as if I was standing before a thundering stereo speaker. Unlike listening to music from afar, sitting in the center of a live performance was even more exciting than the vertical plunge of the roller coaster. This was thrilling. I'm so glad you take the time to write those words for us, because for someone who has never been a part of something like that, they maybe don't begin to fully appreciate just how exciting this can be.
Well, if you've ever been in a concert and fortunate enough to sit near the orchestra, you have some inkling of what it's like. But to sit in the middle of the orchestra is something very different entirely. And the very first concert that I played as a substitute with the New York Philharmonic was Mahler's Sixth Symphony, which is this enormous, tragic, epic work. I was 22, and I came in for the first rehearsal and sat, and the music and the sensation around me was just like nothing I'd ever felt before. For every, you know, rock fan who stands in front of the speaker and has that sort of wave of sound come through him, there's a classical musician who's experienced the equivalent of the same thing. And I really want to, I mean, in the book, I try to describe all of these musical experiences so that people will be as turned on and excited by music as I am and realize it's something accessible on this extremely simple level. There's so much of a sentiment out there that you have to have a PhD to understand music when it is the simplest thing in the world to just sit down and experience and understand.
I maybe should have mentioned, or I might have misspoken, that this North Carolina School of the Arts was actually something, a place where you spent most of your high school years. And you write about as you got through your to the end of your 11th grade year, you said, you know, trying to sort out your feelings about music and what you wanted to do. You said parts of playing music were intoxicating, almost addictive. However, most of it was dull and didn't look like it could lead anywhere. And that's, of course, a familiar refrain as well, certainly with the college music students, which I work with, is there will be this interesting mix of mountaintop experiences of making music combined with a lot of other stuff, which is not nearly so fun, sometimes not fun at all.
Well, for example, right now I'm not playing regularly. I'm doing a lot of other things. But to keep my playing up, and now I've learned to play the soprano saxophone too, since I in the last year, I sit down for 15 minutes with each instrument and go through all the scales and several different exercises just to stay in shape because I do have some things coming up. That is deadly dull, but I have to do it. It's kind of I guess like people like myself who go running every day. It's dull, but you have to do it in order to experience the other thing. However, I didn't notice, and this is, I mean, I want to stress that the time I was at the North Carolina School of the Arts was 30 years ago. The school was brand new. It was kind of an untested concept, and what they didn't have together back then with the high school academic education, I think they've really gotten together now. I mean, they have some of the highest SAT scores in the state, which was not true when I was in school. There were very few academics for us, so getting into a regular university, even the state university, was not looking good for a lot of us.
You know, it's funny. You tell the story of taking the SAT and of fiddling with the answer sheet, filling in random bubbles like abstract art. I mean, that's sort of a metaphor for the kind of education which you received there back then, not a well-rounded education at all.
Well, and even I have this funny story that the friend who actually said this recounted to me again recently. She was a ballerina and a violinist, and we were on the bus going to this SAT test. Quite a few people had not a clue what it was. Nobody told us where we were going. She said, "What does SAT mean? Are we going there because it's Saturday?" You know, and it took this poor person who's very, very bright 5 years to get through college on a regular, you know, full-time schedule because we were really not prepared.
We're speaking with Blair Tyndall about her book called Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music. Even at the North Carolina School of the Arts, and certainly once you get to New York City and begin studying there, we begin to see some other elements besides music entering your life. Things like selling marijuana and experiencing some sexual encounters with peers and even some older folks and so on. I mean, it's a colorful life that you are leading, even at this relatively early age. I'm just curious, did that kind of spring into being in this community of musicians, or was that always a little bit of a part of your own personal makeup?
Well, it's certainly always been present in the community of musicians, and frankly, in pretty much every community. I think I was quite the frisky young person and far more prone to get into trouble, not severe trouble, but get into some kind of trouble than many people. I mean, there were many of my classmates were a lot more disciplined and a lot better behaved than I was, but I was just sort of one of these unbridled young people who wants to try everything, so I did.
You know, it's interesting. As I read your book, I teach at a college in addition to this radio job, and one of the issues which gets grappled with a whole lot is something like student drinking. Mm-hmm. And the fact that so often, depending on a student and their particular circle, they really will feel like everybody is doing this, and they just kind of get swept along with it. And of course, it isn't true. I mean, a lot of college students drink, a lot of students where I teach drink, but they don't all drink. But you can really have that mistaken impression depending on where you are and who you're hanging around with. Nowhere in your book do you ever say all classical musicians in New York City, you know, do the kind of things which you were doing or the people around you were doing. And yet I wonder, as you were kind of experiencing a lot of this, did it feel that way to you? Did it feel like this is part of what it means to be an aspiring young musician or even a full-fledged professional musician in this place?
Well, I have to stress that much of the sex and drugs part of the book takes place in the late 70s, early 80s, which was a time when we didn't know AIDS existed, and the sexual revolution was kind of winding down. So there's quite the attitude of, you know, free love with no consequences still in the air. And also, if you remember this whole Studio 54 era and that time in New York when the mergers and acquisitions were causing, you know, great wealth, there was an enormous amount of drug abuse everywhere, and cocaine was present everywhere. I wouldn't say everyone was doing it, but the vast majority of classical musicians were at least on the periphery of this. And I also want to stress, I never really did do cocaine, but I was around people who were doing a lot of it, and people's lives who were just ruined by, I mean, their lives were just ruined by doing cocaine, and also, you know, the cost of the actual dollar cost of doing all of this every night. So in the early 80s, it was just present everywhere. Those people who abused cocaine back then, a lot of them won't even drink coffee now. I mean, it's really 20, 25 years later, kind of cycled back to this very holistic, healthy lifestyle and one of a lot of discipline. You also cannot keep up playing an instrument on a very high level if you're abusing drugs or alcohol for very long. You can probably do it for a while and then come to the point when you think you're playing fabulously, but you're really not.
In fact, you tell a story, I think, about one of the first rehearsals you had as a sub for the New York Philharmonic, and you showed up for that rehearsal under Klaus Tennstedt with alcohol on your breath and were not able to play anywhere near
I never would have done that in a premeditated way, but I'd gone out the night before. I was only 22. Drinking with some college buddies, and the phone rang, you know, 4 hours after I got home, and I was still pretty tipsy. I was still quite tipsy, and it was the New York Philharmonic. Can you come in at 10 a.m.? I mean, it was everybody's worst nightmare. I mean, I never in a million years.
Well, good news and bad news.
I never would have ever shown up at the New York Philharmonic anywhere near a drinking episode, but that was just very bad luck.
Well, yeah, although I suppose, you know, on the other hand, the more you learned about this life, the more you realize you never know when the phone's going to ring and what magnificent opportunity might be right around the corner. I mean, in some respects, you have to create a life which will allow you to be ready for those opportunities when the phone rings.
Well, that taught me a valuable lesson. And indeed, whenever I was booked to play as a substitute somewhere, play second oboe, I made sure I knew the first oboe part just in case something happened, which it did on occasion.
Hmm. Let's step back for just a moment. What takes you to New York City is actually being part of the Manhattan School of Music. Tell us quickly just a little bit about this school and what drew you there and your experience there.
Well, going back to the North Carolina School of the Arts, as I was graduating from high school, I was really there wasn't exactly any college counseling going on there, and I was at a loss for what to do. My SAT scores, at least the math scores, were abysmal. And my teacher at the North Carolina School of the Arts was going to New York, and he was going to be teaching exclusively at Manhattan School, which is a music conservatory, much like Juilliard, that has been in existence for about 100 years. And it's indeed housed in the old Juilliard building at 122nd Street, where Juilliard was before it moved to Lincoln Center in the 60s. So I applied there, and I did apply to Juilliard and got into both, but I decided to go to Manhattan School. And an application for these conservatories is largely based on your live audition. So you go to New York and play a little bit for the faculty, and they accept you or not. So I enrolled in Manhattan School of Music as a freshman in 1978 and got two performance degrees there. And then by that time, I was out working and able to make a living as a classical musician, which would be a lot more difficult today because there's less going on.
Hmm. Tell us a bit about the Allendale, where you initially lived. You liken it to the Ellis Island of classical musicians, or what a wonderful way to put it.
The Allendale is a famous building in classical music, and it's indeed been written up in the New York Times a couple of times. It was built in 1910 as a super luxurious residential building on West End Avenue, which was kind of the Park Avenue of the West Side at the time. And it was a time before income tax, so people's salaries and incomes were very extravagant, and they had three apartments per floor of 14 rooms each, and it was just, you know, mahogany inlaid floors and beautiful stucco on the outside. It was a real luxury building, no expense spared. Then income tax came about, and people's lives sort of got downsized, and the building fell into a little bit of disrepair, I think. A lot of fairly famous people lived there. I mean, it's got quite a history. The first transcontinental amateur radio broadcast originated from that building. Rudolph Valentino's coroner lived in that building and made the arrangements for his funeral from there. The first policewoman in New York lived there. I mean, it's got a very interesting history. But by 1960, it had fallen a little bit on hard times, and people's housing needs were different. So a landlord bought the building in 1960 and divided it up into these much smaller apartments. And a few years later, a couple of musicians, and I'm not even sure who started the whole trend, moved in and found that it was cheap. Nobody seemed to complain about their practicing because by this point there were several musicians in the building. And if they didn't complain about maintenance and the building was already in disrepair again, the landlord didn't give them a hard time about anything. So pretty soon people were saying, oh, if you come to this building and give the rental agent $300 under the table, you'll get an apartment. Just use my name, and it's a great place for musicians. Hmm. So it got this reputation, and indeed, I just showed up and did exactly that and got an apartment.
Yeah, and you say some of New York's hot tickets started in the Allendale. I mean, you could really make powerful connections with people. One of the people who lived there was a flutist by the name of Sidney, and she seems to have been an important figure for you in it. One point you talk about looking at her life as a professional flutist with great envy. You say, I wanted all of Sidney's beauty and success. Tell us a little more about, just for instance, the life that she was leading and what kind of influence she was over you.
Well, I looked upon this person as something of a sort of what any musician would aspire to be. She was fabulously talented. She was brilliant. I mean, she was very smart. She was well-read. She could have done a million things, and she chose this. She was very successful. She was great with other people, just beautiful and cultured. And she was everything that I aspired to be, sort of being from not the sticks of North Carolina, but maybe not from as refined a background. And one of the reasons I wanted to feature Sidney in the book was that here is somebody with, you know, as much promise as any young person can have, and here was what was available to her to, you know, in a life in music. And it's, you know, there were wonderful moments, but it's also very limiting. And here's somebody who could have done anything in the world, and she chose this very, very challenging lifestyle, and sometimes it just didn't reward her in the way that such a talented and beautiful and intelligent person deserves to be rewarded for the amount of work they do.
Hmm.
So by the end of the book, she was quite frustrated. And I would assume she's still experiencing those frustrations with the occasional kind of burst of elation at a great concert.
Hmm. One of the things you say about Sydney, who early on was doing a lot of what you would come to do, this substituting in various ensembles as a freelance musician, you write, as a freelancer, Sydney's personality was strong enough to hold her own, yet savvy enough not to threaten the principal player who hired her. I mean, that is such an interesting little bit of, I don't know, psychology slash politics. Tell us a little more about what you are saying there and how that tricky little matter typically plays out, or played out for you at least.
Well, there's an interesting feature of the bylaws of the New York Musicians Union in that it is illegal to audition for a freelance orchestra. It's all the hiring is done through networking, which is very different from something like the Milwaukee Symphony, which is a major orchestra, and they advertise in the union paper and have these blind auditions, like anyone who read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, read about this. So that something like Milwaukee has very, very fewer auditions. These freelance groups in New York, of course they're looking for the best players, but it is a whole networking thing, like much in the business world.
Can you, I don't mean to interrupt, but can you explain why that it is done so differently, done the way it is, why it should be illegal to have clear and fair auditions?
I'm not sure why that came about, but the difference between a major orchestra and these orchestras are that these are quite part-time. I mean, some of these orchestras have concerts maybe 3 to 5 weekends out of the year. Some of them might play once a month. So they're kind of transient. I'm not sure how that bylaw came about. It was there when I came to New York in 1978. But in any case, any freelance music scene is largely done through this networking. So the person who hires you ends up being the principal player in the group. So you want to be a good player and a supportive player, but you also don't want, of course, that person to feel threatened, because we all have very fragile egos, and if you feel threatened by someone, or they're trying to, you know, zoom in on your job and take it away from you, you're not inclined to recommend them again for work. The networking has another interesting aspect of, this is the sex part, this is a very small community on a very strange schedule. So when you fall in love and have relationships and friendships and marriages, they really do end up being with fellow musicians. You're on tour with them, you're working at night with them. And when you have a falling out with someone, it can be disastrous and have ripples through, you know, many of your jobs and many of your employers. So, I mean, it's just a very incestuous, tightly knit community. And I've had people just be amazed when they get to know somebody, say in a chamber orchestra, at how many people in the same orchestra have a history over the years, or even have been married to each other. Sometimes there are multiple former marriages within the same group.
Well, it's interesting, too. I don't think we stop to think about how that changes everything about the way people connect with one another, in the sense that you sort of start to wonder if anybody is interested in anybody else purely for personal reasons, versus I'm interested in you for what you maybe can give me or get for me, or how I can be advanced through who you are. I mean, that's a really interesting subtext to relationships, and probably at the time you're not even fully aware of just how much that can change everything.
Well, like, I'm living in Hollywood now, just like Hollywood. It's interesting how much, you know, friendships can be predicated on that, and how quickly they can dry up when, you know, a desired event doesn't come about. So I think even though a lot of that is subconscious, some of it's conscious, but a lot of it's subconscious, it's so tightly woven in with the social lives of musicians that it's, you know, it's kind of an unpleasant consequence of this career that is not so present in something like a major orchestra, where you're not dependent on your colleagues for survival.
We are speaking with Blair Tyndall about her book, Mozart in the Jungle. I had forgotten, I just was glancing at it again, when you tell the story of getting that call from the New York Philharmonic to be substitute second oboe, you likened it to the nightmare which so many musicians, me included, have had repeatedly of waking up and you realize you're in the middle of a concert and you're holding the wrong instrument. I mean, you're a flutist, but you're holding the violin instead, or you've rehearsed for Beethoven's Fifth and they're playing Shostakovich's Fifth or something like that. I mean, or you wake up and you're about to perform and you're inebriated and you realize, but in this case, you realize that was it was actually real life. Tell us how the phone rang and you got such a call to be substitute second oboe for the New York Philharmonic. I mean, in your case, how had that networking worked?
Well, my teacher played principal oboe in the New York Philharmonic, and traditionally they end up using their better students to substitute. So he had, a few months before, I was in graduate school at this point, given my name to the personnel manager. And it was a year, here's an interesting little detail. The second oboe player was the father of the CNN reporter Richard Roth that you see on the air all the time.
Yes.
Who was just starting out in broadcasting. But this man got sick sometimes, but his wife was quite ill and, in fact, dying. So he was out a good bit of the year, and I ended up playing something like a quarter of the season the year I was in graduate school, which was very exciting. So that's how that comes about. Somebody doesn't make it in for whatever reason. They're ill. You know, there's a snowstorm. They have car trouble. So that's how that happens. But I was, as you can imagine, sound asleep. I had gotten home at 4 in the morning, and the phone rang. It's a little after 7. I didn't even hear it. And my roommate came in and was shaking me, Blair, it's the New York Philharmonic. And I was just not clear-headed and trying to write down all of this information and making, you know, repeating it back to him. I must have just seemed like the village idiot. So I got myself together and got myself down there. And I believe we were rehearsing Tchaikovsky Fifth with Pinchstedt. And everything was going pretty well. Fortunately, my teacher wasn't in. There was another substitute playing first oboe. And we're going along, and I see some low notes, which are very hard to play delicately on the oboe. I see there's some low notes coming up on the
oboe. Oh, yes, the low C sharp.
And it's a little woodwind chorale. I know from the piece what's coming. I've never played the piece before. I'm just hoping for the best. I didn't have a great read. And indeed, when that moment came, not only did the note not come out softly, it honked. I played the wrong note. So it was one of those moments where it was just, I was living the nightmare.
Mm. So interesting, too, even before we get to that little moment, which is fascinating, you write about it so well. You talk about how thrilling it was being physically part of such a glorious sound. You said it was fabulous. I desperately wanted to feel every second of it in case this was my only chance to sit in the middle of the New York Philharmonic. I mean, I just can't imagine what that would feel like to wonder if, is this it? And then you said, yet I was terrified. These confident musicians knew one another well and played together like a precision machine, each one adjusting to the other. I was a good student, but not nearly as seasoned as these musicians. I tried to fit my tone underneath their timbre and finally started to relax in my anonymity. I mean, it's just fascinating to think about all the things that go on if one is sitting in the middle of the New York Philharmonic as a substitute. I mean, wanting desperately to be part of this and yet sort of relieved to be sort of anonymous until this rather exposed moment comes. But I mean, it's not really easy to put into words. You do a very good job, however, of helping us understand all the kind of conflicting emotions that would be part of this experience.
Well, that's an important part of the book, that, you know, people come to classical music concerts and, you know, have not seen all the work and preparation of a lifetime that goes into, say, a New York Philharmonic concert. And, you know, they expect, sort of imagine sometimes that people spring from the womb fully formed and, you know, playing the violin perfectly like this. But so much goes into it, there's so much trial and error, there's a lot of heartbreak and angst along the way. And indeed, when the book first came out a year ago in hardback, it just came out in paperback, a lot of the comments I got and the comments on the Amazon page and comments at book reading were very sort of judgmental about, well, you shouldn't be in music anyway if you're going to play a wrong note in the New York Philharmonic, you know, as if, well, I'm sorry, but even the finest musicians play wrong notes at times. You know, it's a life, you know, it's a passionate life that's not cookie cutter clean. It's got so many interesting, fascinating details, and it's not a life of perfection either. And I think it's very important for people to realize and understand that musicians are very dedicated and disciplined people, but they're also just as fallible as anyone else who's a human being.
Hmm. You write about how the phone rings a second time. I mean, despite this first rehearsal, which didn't go terribly well for you, and it is Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, one of the great masterworks of all time, led by none other than the legendary Leonard Bernstein. And you say even the most apathetic musicians rode his raw energy as he clutched emotion from thin air, dancing like a drunken sailor, moaning and snorting. The performance was more than just the music. It was an orgy that threw the heart, the soul, and all the senses into a superhuman sphere. I mean, that just takes our breath away to think of anyone having that experience. I mean, on the stage, let alone in the audience.
Well, even in the New York Times review, it was summed up in a single word, wow. Which is not something you see in the classical music section too often.
And I appreciate it so much, you know, as you conclude this section about subbing with the New York Philharmonic, you say, I could barely believe my good fortune. Just 4 years earlier, I had predicted a grim future for myself, and here I was substituting with one of the world's great orchestras. My success was not only a resume entry, but more significantly, a source of great spiritual growth and delight, a unique high that eluded words. I mean, that this was, you knew, even as a young musician, that this was about a whole lot more than what it might seem to be on the surface. This was a powerful experience that nourished you.
It was indeed. It nourished me, and it also, you know, sort of, it made me hungry for more, not only in music, but other things in life, too. I mean, it made me realize how much is possible, and there's something about art that just, it makes life seem so much better than the reality, that you're always striving to make life actually become that special, which is a wonderful quality, I think, that a lot of people in the arts have.
Hmm. You certainly experienced that time and again with another group, a very different group, the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. I have a feeling a lot of the people listening to our interview might even have on their shelf, if they have any classical music collection at all, might very likely have an LP or CD that features the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. Remind us of what makes this group something quite distinctive in the musical pantheon.
Oh, the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra is just a fantastic small orchestra that plays without a conductor. And they're sort of a democratic organization. They formed themselves in the mid-70s and decided they were going to play in the old European tradition of playing a chamber orchestra as if you're a string quartet with no conductor, with the concertmaster or first violinist doing most of the leading, and people making decisions and having meetings before the first rehearsal to decide on things like repertoire and tempos and style and all of that sort of thing. And it's a real challenging sort of situation that seems to be of huge interest to people even in the business world, because they go into corporations now and sometimes do these seminars where they sort of teach teamwork and that sort of thing through playing together and also discussing how these musical decisions are arrived upon. You can imagine with 26 people in a room, each with a strong opinion of how something should go, and a couple of people, you know, who might not like each other, and a couple of people ganging up on some cellist. It can, you know, arguments ensue, hijinks ensue.
Mm.
So in any case, it was a group that was kind of unprecedented, and it was very exciting to play with them. In fact, it was the best musical experience of my life, and I just loved the tours that I was fortunate enough to go on with Orpheus.
You quote someone reviewing one of their performances as a headless wonder.
It's a nice way was. I mean, anybody who's ever heard it's remarkable, really. I mean, it's one thing to just talk about it, but even if you don't know anything about classical music, to go to Carnegie Hall and see these 26 people walk out on stage all together, bow, sit down, and start playing on their own, there's something amazing about it, just organic. It takes on a life of its own. It's quite exciting.
Yeah. I still remember a performance I saw at Ravinia with the great bass baritone Thomas Kwasthoff and a small chamber orchestra from Europe that accompanied him in a program mostly of Bach and some Mozart. And that also, there was no conductor. So they performed very much in the same way. And that was really extraordinary. But, of course, your typical Baroque piece, I mean, at least it has, from start to finish of a given movement, a consistent tempo. The Orpheus Chamber Orchestra does not limit itself to that. I mean, they will do even impassioned romantic works, and they somehow hold it together in a way that's truly extraordinary.
Well, I mean, first of all, a lot of this music is quite known to us, you know, so it's not as if you have to figure out the mechanics of it. And there's also, I mean, this is going to sound like I should be in Roswell, New Mexico, looking for UFOs, but there's a certain psychic communication when you're playing music where you just understand when somebody's going to do something. You communicate in a way where you just know when somebody's going to play louder or somebody's going to hesitate a little bit. It's an amazing thing. I don't really understand how the mind works, but there's this tension in the air, and it most of the time it happens.
Well, and I think it was at the end of the first concert you played with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, you say at the end, the audience leapt to their feet in a wild ovation, accepting rough edges for a chance to hear the risky thrills of Orpheus. I mean, that is so interesting there. I mean, we get a sense that maybe one is giving up sheer perfection, whatever that means, but it is oh so worth it. When you're hearing something else that just has this no-holds-barred quality to it.
It is, and that's, I mean, it's sort of the very, very positive extreme of music making, and it's something that was so refreshing to me after going and auditioning for all of these 25 orchestras that I auditioned for. You know, I would schlep to these cities and go sit behind the screen where nobody can see you and play 5 minutes of the Mozart concerto and a few orchestral excerpts, and I mean, I've been on the other side of the screen, so I do understand that you sort of have to, you're looking for reasons to eliminate somebody, so there's a lot of kind of musical boringness, and you know, you're looking for perfection, you're looking for somebody who's perfectly in tune, very resonant, consistent sound, but Orpheus, because they were really going for the music, or they still do really go for the music, is sort of the antithesis of that. It's okay to crash and burn. I mean, not that they do. You rarely hear anything like that, but it's kind of, it goes with the territory that if you are really going for something, you always do run the risk of going a little too far.
Blair Tyndall and her best-selling memoir about her experience as a professional oboist in New York City is called Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music. A highly regarded television series produced by Amazon has just been renewed for a second season, a television series based on this memoir and bearing the same name, Mozart in the Jungle. On Monday's morning show, local author Carl Swanson joins us. He just had a book signing at Andrea's gift shop, and we'll be talking with him about his book about Selma and the events of 1965. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. We remind you that Wisconsin Public Radio's winter membership drive is underway. Please take a moment to give them a call and express your support and appreciation for Wisconsin Public Radio and for the programs like The Morning Show, which you hear over WGTD. Their phone number is 1-888-202-2552, 1-888-202-2552.